Hello, this is Alex Roman, executive editor for Metro Magazine, and welcome to Metrospectives, a podcast about public transit, the private motor coach industry, and all things mobility. My guest today is transit evangelist Paul Comfort. Comfort joins me to discuss his recent trip to UITP MENA in Dubai, where their taxicabs are part of transit's overall mobility network. We also discuss why some mobility models are slow to mature here in the States, his forthcoming book on equity and inclusion, and how he is merging his love for music and public transit. And now, my talk with Paul. Well, again, thanks to Paul Comfort for joining us. Third time here. I really appreciate you coming on. How's it going?
It's going great, Alex. Thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for joining us. You know, as usual, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I know you got back from a big trip at UATP. I guess it's MENA. Is that
how? That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Middle East, North Africa. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that trip? You know, what was the reason for being out there? And you know, what kind of things did you learn out there?
Yeah. Well, thank you. And thanks for having me on. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Metro and all the work you do there.
Thank you.
One of the great things about working for the company I work for, I'm now kind of working at a group level for this company called Medaxo. Medaxo is the parent company of companies like Trapeze, Voluntis, and TripSpark. But they have a global presence. And so that's one of the cool things about working for a company like that is you get invitations to come to things around the world. Our podcast, Transit Unplugged, now has really broadened its reach. We're in 100 countries. And Chartable just ranked us among the top 200 podcasts in the world. I actually can't believe it personally, but I know we have listeners everywhere because I get, you know, notes from people all the time about it. Yeah. So we had a lot of fans in the Middle East and in North Africa because we've done several shows there over the last couple of years during the pandemic when we couldn't travel. You know, I'm doing these podcasts like you're doing with me over Zoom. And so I got an invitation from UITP, which is kind of like the international APTA for people who don't know. They're the International Transportation Association. And there's, I don't know, like 1,300 transit systems around the world that are members, maybe more than that. And Mohamed Mezgani is the CEO of the group. And they invited me to come and speak at their North Africa Middle East conference being held in Dubai. Well, that's, you know, going to Dubai has always been one of my bucket list items, you know, one of the coolest cities in the world. So I accepted. My company's like, yeah, actually our Middle East group of Trapeze is hosting a booth there. So you can come be a part of what we're doing. We'll set up a whole thing for you to do podcast interviews and record an episode of your new Transit Unplugged TV show there and all that. You could speak. And then they asked me also to moderate a big panel on the main stage. So it was a great experience. I it was a long trip over there. I went on Emirates Air, which I would recommend to anybody. More leg room. They're very kind. You know, even though it's a long flight, like a 12 and a half hour flight there, 14 hours back, it didn't seem that bad at all. So I got there on a Sunday and went over to see the trade show getting set up. And then really it all kicked off that evening. We had a dinner with some CEOs from Gabon, a nation in Africa, and also a country that used to be called the Ivory Coast. People probably heard of that. And then some folks from Saudi Arabia. We had a dinner, man, right next to the mall, the Dubai Mall, which is really famous. It's other than the mall we have in Minnesota, I think it's the world's largest mall. And right. They've got like dancing fountains there, just like you would have, you know, at the hotels in Las Vegas. And it's right in front of the Burj Khalifa, which is the world's tallest building. People that, you know, saw Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible, whatever number it was, climbing up the wall of that, you know, the outside glass of that. So it was phenomenal. You know, the weather was great. And the conference, so that was a wonderful dinner, getting to know people, socializing. And I got to tell you, Alex, one of the coolest things about the whole trip was eating Middle Eastern food for the whole time.
Right.
And it just is so delicious and healthy. We were eating like Lebanese style, you know, small dishes. They bring out like 10 or 12 different things. You take a little bit of everything, family style, just phenomenal. The meats, everything was just the vegetables, just had a whole different taste. And something that wasn't just me that noticed, but a guy named Scott Winks, who's our portfolio manager over there, told me, and I hadn't said this to him ahead of time, but I told my taxi driver and another person, I said, the air just smells different to me here. And it feels different in the Middle East. It had like a sweet smell. I don't know how to describe it. And Scott said to me, did you notice the air smells a little different here? I said, yes, I did. So just, yeah, I don't know what it is, the desert air or something, but you know, they built this city out of sand. You know, like in the last 50 years, it's come from nothing to, I actually took a bus tour of old Dubai, you know, and the city's less than like 100 years old, but they're really just you know, the structures, it's phenomenal. It's just the commitment to excellence that the leadership of that country has is just great. And they're, you know, they're kind of an open country, right? They're one of the ones, United Arab Emirates, which they're a part of. Right. United Arab Emirates is the nation. And then Dubai is like the commercial capital of that country. But they're open, you know, they have relationships with Israel. You know, it's a great country. So that was kind of the opening to it. And then I spoke at the conference on, you know, what are the top trends? And I think everybody knows what's going on, but just to tag it, you know, I think these are the six top trends happening right now. People are, well, we'll talk about it later. We'll get into it. But there's things happening in transit that we can talk about later. But it was fun. And then I moderated a panel with just some great people over in Dubai and in the Middle East. There's a company called Careem. And Careem is their Uber. Uber actually bought them. They were a local company and they bought them and they've turned that. So I got to meet some of the people there. My friend Joe Ma, who was the former deputy general manager of the Shenzhen Bus Group, is now an advisor to the CEO of the Saudi Public Transport Company. Got to hang out with him. Leon Daniels, the guy that, you know, was from Transport for London. He's the one that made the decision as head of their surface transportation to shut down Uber for a while. Bernard Tabry, the head of Keolis International, were all there. A bunch of other great, fun people were there to hang out with. So we spoke about, you know, smart mobility management, and folks from the Dubai transportation system, Khalid Al-Awadi was there. And then a great lady, Christina Guell from the Barcelona Transit Agency was there from Spain. And they're going to be hosting the next big UITP International Summit, which will probably have, you know, 10,000 people there in Spain next year. And another lady named Anan El-Amri, who is the head of sustainable mobility from the Integrated Transport Center in Abu Dhabi. The biggest lesson that I took from the whole conference was how Dubai handles taxi cabs differently, Alex. I've never seen it like this before. So there's a place called the Dubai Roads and Transport Authority or whatever, and their CEO is a great guy, Ahmad Barozi. He's been on my podcast before. I got to interview him in his office there for my TV show. But the Transport Authority actually owns 5,000 of the 10,000 cabs that are in the city.
Right.
And so they integrate them into their transit network, just like cities in America would do with Uber or Lyft. You know, if they have software which allows you to kind of track where the vehicles go. Well, they've got it there. They've got the software that tracks them. Actually, what's funny is my company's the one that made it, and the hardware. And in every taxi cab, there's 11,000 cabs in Dubai. And in every cab you get in, there's a mobile data terminal that says Trapeze right on it. It's kind of wild. But they use Customer Connect. They have live translation with artificial intelligence. So if you speak a different language than the driver, you know, it's automatically translated for you from the back of the seat you're sitting in to the front of the driver. You can share your destination just like you can on Uber, you know, your live location. There's multiple cameras in the vehicle that are live showing, you know, what's happening. And you can book your trip just like you would book an Uber or Lyft, but you book a taxi cab on that. And there's all kinds of new technology coming that we're providing actually too, which is cool. Where with 11,000 cab drivers and two or three shifts a day, it's all going to be on their phone where they don't need a key anymore. They don't have to transfer keys. The right. car is dropped off. The driver comes up. If it's there, you know, they thumb in or they do a facial recognition and it allows them to start the car up with their phone. You know, all kinds of amazing like 21st century technology that we're putting in there. But they use taxi cabs as part of their overall transit network. So they, you know, it's microtransit. Taxi cabs are microtransit in Dubai. They integrate them right in. It's first and last mile solution. It gets super hot, you know, in Dubai, 120, 130 degrees, 50 Celsius. So people don't even want to walk, you know, 50 yards to a bus stop. Right. They'd rather have somebody pick them up right at their house in the cab or at their business, at their office, walk out, get in the cab, and then have the cab take them to the metro station or whatever. So that was a really unique thing. I'm actually going to be talking about it at Smart Transit next week in Boston about how taxi cabs are used I used to work for Yellow Cab, Mark Joseph in Baltimore. You know, I was the vice president of his bus service. We had 700 cabs in Baltimore. It was run completely separately. You know, we didn't really like have any interaction with them with our transit service. But over there, it's fully integrated. It's, you know, up in the operations control center. They've got the cabs up on the screen. Somebody needs a trip, they send a cab to get them, and then they hook them in with a bus or the rail or whatever. It's just really interesting. And I think it's a model that, you know, taxi cabs have really taken a beating during the COVID pandemic. And it's a great way to have them actually pick up more business. They're an important part of our, you know, our overall public mobility network. And as transit agencies start moving away from, as Nat Ford has taught us over the last few years, we're not the only providers of transit. We're also aggregators of what's available in the community to provide an overall network of, you know, mobility mosaic or whatever in the community. And they use cabs in a way there that no one else that I've seen does. I think other cities like Singapore may, and some other cities, but I haven't seen it in the West. And so it's a model that I'm really enthused about, and I think is something we could learn from.
I think everybody knows, you did some time there in Maryland as the transit administration, I guess the administrator, is that
your? Yeah, CEO and administrator, yeah. In Baltimore, the Baltimore bus system based in the subway system and all that jazz.
Yeah, and you know, like a program like that, I feel like the taxis and transit and you know, a lot in the shorter kind of history, same kind of relationship with Uber and Lyft, kind of adversarial a little bit.
Yes, that's right.
Can you talk about like, you know, why that kind of relationship is existent here in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So I just had a guy named Paul Tolliver. Paul has been longtime CEO of a number of transit systems across the country and, you know, spent a lot of time in Seattle and helped the Detroit comeback and all that. He's kind of like one of the godfathers of transit in America. I've actually got him coming to another conference with me, but I just did a top 7 over 70 podcast with all these, you know, older folks who have been in the industry a long time. And he just told me his whole story. And we were talking about how, you know, hey, in America, most transit, remember back in the 50s, was run by the utility companies, the electric companies. Right. It still is in a few cities like in the North Carolina and South Carolina down there, I think. But because they were, you know, trolley lines, right, with electric power. And so it made sense for them. They were they had a monopoly on the power in their community. And so then they went, had powered vehicles in the cities. So like Baltimore, my city and other cities had trolley services that were run by private companies. And then after World War II, when all the guys came back from the war and people's car ownership started picking up over the 60s and 70s, there just wasn't enough riders in public transit to really make a go of it, to make a profit. And so almost every one of them went bankrupt or sold their transit companies, you know, to the government. And so cities and state governments picked them up, and then it became a monopoly, right? And so then these transit agencies were like, I'm a government agency. We're the only one that runs this in the city, and you can't really make a profit running transit. You know, MJ Maynard in Vegas comes the closest to it on her downtown routes, where they actually, for a while pre-COVID, were recovering, fare box recovery ratio was over 100%. That's the only ones. You got the most, you know, because you got hundreds of thousands of people who are tourists who are going to ride, you know, those buses up and down the strip. But other than that, no one's making money in transit in America. The costs are just too high. And in order to allow people to ride without having to pay a $6 ticket or a $10 ticket, you know, it's going to be subsidized. So basically, the government agency run transit systems grew up without competition. And they felt like, you know, I own the market, right? So there was an uneasy relationship with taxi cabs and buses. But when Uber and Lyft came on the scene in the 90s, and in, well, actually early 2000s when they really came on strong, remember that's when we had a 7-year decline in ridership. And most transit CEOs, I was one of them. I remember back in 2015, APTA held a CEO, you know, their annual CEO conference. It was in Florida. And I remember the talk of the town was, what are we going to do? You know, our hair's on fire because ridership continues to decline. And our, you know, our bosses, the legislatures and the city councils and the boards, they look at one key performance indicator, right? That's it's ridership. I think it's a false idol personally. And I think that COVID showed that. We've been worshiping at a false idol, as what I call it, to throw a little spiritual lingo in there, you know? and we need to, you know, the true thing we should be focused on is a lot broader than just the raw number of people. I mean, and people are figuring that out now that, you know, we can achieve policy objectives like, you know, environmental stewardship and equity inclusion. Mm-hmm. Transit can be so much more than just A to B. But anyway, I think that's a long answer to your question. But so when Uber and Lyft came in, they were seen as scavengers taking our choice riders away from us. And and that's why we felt like ridership declined, in addition to gas prices declining and other things. But, you know, now we've seen that completely change over the last 5 years. Again, Nat Ford's really the one that led it when he was chairman of APTA. He said, hey, you know, he didn't quite say if you can't beat them, join them. But the thought was that transit agencies should shift our modus operandi. And we shouldn't see ourselves as the only providers of transit. So like when I was in Baltimore, I had 6 modes. The main 6 modes you would have. I had bus, the regular 40-foot bus. We had 750 buses. We had light rail that went to Camden Yards. Everybody knows that. Our old Governor Schaefer wanted it to go to Camden Yards, the Orioles baseball stadium, the day it opened, and they got it open. Then we had a subway system that serves Johns Hopkins University and a few others, a small subway. Right. And then we had commuter bus. We had 750 motor coaches that we contracted with. We had a commuter train service called Mark Train that fed Union Station in downtown Washington, D.C. And then we had paratransit. So we had the six primary modes. But what started happening was, right, bike shares came in, scooters came in, Uber came in, Lyft came in. The city started operating Circulator. There was a little boat service down in the harbor. So all these other services came in. And, you know, Kevin Quinn and I, Kevin now is head of TransLink in Canada, but he was my head planning director. We talked about, you know, we should bring these guys in and try to work with them. So I had meetings with Lyft and Uber. Uber was difficult to work with at first. Lyft was a little more easy for us, to be honest with you. Now, I think Uber is more open to working in concert with public transit agencies. But we were trying to figure out a way to bring it all together. So traditionally, though, you know, they were, for the first few years, they were seen as people who were taking our riders from us. But now we see it as, no, you know, it's a cornucopia of options for people. And we want to, as a transit agency, though, I still think that they need to be kind of overseeing it. That's why I think they should be the ones that have the mobility as a service app, you know, like Dallas did, you know, under Gary Thomas, where they put together an app and they had everybody on the transit agency app. People don't want 10 apps on their phone to get a ride. They want one ultimate app. You know, like I was just in Florida last week filming for the show, and I met with Patrick Goddard, who's the CEO of Brightline Trains, and interviewed him. Great guy. And, you know, he's doing the same thing. He's trying to work with the Miami transit system and with the Palm Beach transit system so that they're all kind of on one app together, I think. They're going further. They're doing the bikes and the last mile pickup and all that. But he wants to include it all. And even so you can pay for everything with one app, you know, right. So you don't have to use multiple types of payment options. So that's what's happening, I think. And that is the hot trend right now coming out of COVID is cities are integrating. That's what I spoke about actually at the Dubai conference and what I'll be speaking about over the next three or four conferences. Alex, I've spoken, I think I counted it, 125 events over the last 15 months around the world.
Wow, with COVID.
Maybe 100 of them have been online, but about 25 been in person. And that's the hottest trend right now, right? It's environmental stewardship, equity, inclusion, right. But it's also this integrating everything that's happening in your city, integrating all the public mobility options and focusing on customer experience. So they'll get back on the bus.
I think with, technology obviously is something that's advanced and companies like Trapeze, other companies are building apps and white label apps and those sorts of things. Obviously they have the capability of bringing that all in. What are the main hurdles from the transit perspective and being able to forge those partnerships with the ride shares, the bike shares, Uber, Lyft, taxi cabs, and that sort of thing?
So I think, I've spent a lot of my career, not just in transit, but also in government. I think you know that, you know, I was a county administrator, county commissioner, ran for office a bunch of times. I'm a strong believer in local government. The power of local government closest to the people can really make a difference in people's lives. And government doesn't do everything well though. You know, I remember in my county, Queen Anne's County, Maryland, where I live now and where I was served as a commissioner and all that, we had a business park we tried to start. And it's funny because when I was in Florida last week, I had lunch with my old economic development director, Susie Ford. She's retired down there. And she was there for me 10, 12 years ago when I was there. And we were talking about, she wanted the county to sell those lots in the business park and to be the one that actually was served like a realtor, but we couldn't sell them all. So finally we brought in an outside company, a realtor who handles commercial properties, and man, they sold the lots left and right. And before you know it, the business park was basically sold out, Chesapeake Bay Business Park. So the point is, that's been, I think, part of the problem is transit agencies have thought they're the end all be all do all. And so, they've been a monopoly, right? We've had this for since, let's say, the 70s. So we've had 40 years of us being the only game in town. Now we're not. Now the private sector's come in, you know, you've got guys like Elon Musk and Sir Richard Branson trying to do Hyperloop, which I think is more science than fiction now. You've got companies like Brightline Trains coming in, which are higher speed rail. You've got all these other smaller companies, autonomous vehicle companies, they're all entering this sphere, and it's because nature abhors a vacuum, right? And so there obviously was a need for it. There is a need for it, or else the market wouldn't support it. Now, you could say a lot of these companies aren't making money yet, so the market doesn't support it, but I think it will get there. Just like Amazon lost money for a while, and now it's, you know, very profitable for Jeff and his family, and those who are shareholders there. So I think that's what happened to transit. But I think we're largely over that, to be honest with you. I think we're past that, and we've realized, yeah, we need to work in concert with them. A good friend of mine, Dmitry Vanchagoff, went to work for Uber in their public transit space. And I know that he and others there are very focused on coordinating with transit agencies. So it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I think we're at a good place now.
That's funny. I just met Dmitry yesterday on a phone
call. Oh, did you?
Yeah.
He's awesome. And you know what's funny about him, Alex? He looks exactly like my firstborn son, Joseph. They look exact. They could be doppelganger twins. They're bald with these big beards, you know, and just phenomenal. I've always told him that you got to meet my son one day. So yeah.
That's funny. And kind of segueing into that, I mean, you know, working with NADA and that sort of thing, contractors obviously are out there worldwide, you know, yes, forging these types of partnerships. How much can they be a catalyst and kind of being kind of the go-between between transit trying to operate as a business and trying to do these things maybe they're incapable of?
That's a good question. So NADA is the North American Transit Alliance. That's what you were just talking about. And mm-hmm. that's a trade association, just like there's an airline association of all these airlines. I mean, you know, Southwest and American and Delta, they are very strong competitors. But when it comes to things where they want to work together, like they just sent a letter to the administration and said, drop the mask mandate, please, you know, right, just like APTA did, you know. And so we have an association for our six big companies, First Transit, Transdev, and MV, Keolis, National Express, RETP Dev. So these are contractors, just like cities contract out trash collection, other things. They contract out paratransit and fixed route transit. And now some of these new micro transit options and you know, shuttles at the airport that you ride. And so contractors come in and they have this worldwide experience you talked about. I mean, let's pick a company like Transdev, who is a, you know, international company. When I went down to Australia a couple of years ago and visited, I got to meet the local Transdev guys, right? Then when I went to France and England a couple of years ago, they have Transdev there, and now here in America, you know? And so they have all kinds of experience. They can do, you know, bulk purchasing of items. Like, so they bring savings to agencies and they bring expertise. And so, yeah, I think transit, we just did a study actually with UITP. UITP did a study for us and we analyzed how contracting is done in Europe. NADA did the study, you know, contracted out to do the study. UITP did it. They compared and contrasted contracting in Europe and Australia versus North America. And really the main, they're very similar, but the main difference is in Europe, they've been doing this contracting longer or better or something. And so they really view their contractors as partners, not as vendors. So you go to Paris, for instance, and RETP Dev, you know, runs a big hunk of the subway system there. And they're seen kind of like as the operator, you know, instead of just a vendor. And so here in America, I think I've worked for some of these companies too. And I know that public transit agencies sometimes haven't always treated them with the respect I think that they deserve. I mean, these are super professionals. People that work in these companies, man, they know how to get stuff done. I know in Baltimore, when I was running the paratransit system, when I got there as CEO of the agency, we had a lawsuit against us from the Maryland Disability Center and AARP. And I was like, when I met with them the first time, I'm like, hey, I'm a member of AARP. Are you using my money to sue me? But anyway, but you know, they felt like our paratransit system wasn't serving, you know, wasn't meeting certain criteria. So we had some contractors there at the time. It was, I think, MV, First Transit, and Transdev. And I let them, I hired a guy named Carl Parr to run it, and we let them do their thing. We didn't micromanage them. We managed them by outputs. We want no more than two preventable accidents per 100,000 miles. We want 92% on-time performance. We want all these key performance indicators. We want the phones answered in a certain amount of time, et cetera, et cetera. But we didn't like dictate the how. We let them use their expertise. And when we did that, it's a perfect example of what happened. Alex, when I left Baltimore in 2000, I think it was 17, we had the highest performing large paratransit system in the country. No doubt about it. We were at 97% on-time performance measured by GPS. We were at one preventable accident per 100,000 miles, you know, only half of what the goal was. And it's because we allowed the contractors to use their expertise to do their thing. So I think there's a lesson to be learned. And it's really, you know, my personal message to transit agencies, having worked in the transit industry now for almost 35 years and having been the CEO of one of America's top 12 transit systems, you know, working as a partner with these contractors is a lot better than treating them kind of like just a vendor who I'm going to dictate the how. Instead, manage by outcomes, and I think you'll get a better result. At least that was my experience.
Yeah. And that system, I mean, is it the way the system is set up overseas? Because I know, you know, funding and all of that is much different than it is here.
Yes.
Is it the way the system's set up, or is it the mindset, or is it kind of a little bit of both?
It's a little bit of both, but it is set up that way in the initial RFP. So when they do what they call a tender overseas, you know, in Europe, they call it a tender. We call it an RFP. But they go out to the market. They a lot of times will ask the market ahead of time, what new technologies can you bring us? Kind of in an RFI process, you know, request for information. And then they set up the bid and the scope of work so that it allows the transit agency to really make use of the expertise of the contractors. And then it's the view of the local, you know, staff that's running it. They understand these are top professionals who really know what they're doing. I mean, you talk to some of these guys, you know, in these other countries and in America, and the leaders of the transit agency contractor general managers are just phenomenal. Most of the time, they're super experienced. You know, guys like Robert Smith, who's been around forever. He was my predecessor at MTA. He works now for RATP Dev. I mean, this guy's a top-notch professional. I mean, he knows his stuff. And allowing him to come in and kind of be an advisor as well as just a contractor, I think, is a good move.
You know, something we haven't had a chance to talk about is, you know, funding and the large bill and good news for transit.
Yeah, man.
I was just kind of wondering, you know, as that comes to fruition, you know, what do you think is the biggest opportunity for transit with an unprecedented surge of funds?
Yes, it's a sea change for our industry. Primarily, public transit in America has been seen as a local responsibility. Local cities have funded the operating costs primarily. The federal government, just like in Canada, has primarily been involved in capital dollars, right? Buying vehicles and facilities. But during this pandemic, when it became clear and obvious to people in Washington that public transit is required to keep the essential workers getting to work, you know, even when we said to everybody during the peak of the pandemic, no one's allowed to ride except for essential workers. You know, while the commuter services dropped off tremendously, the downtown bus services and light rail systems and subways, they all stayed at around 50%. And so people realize, so the wheels in the bus that go round and round are the same wheels that make our economy turn. And so the federal government, I think, picked up on that and decided, you know what, we need to invest in operating dollars in this. And the most recent tranche of funds that Secretary Buttigieg announced, along with Vice President Kamala Harris announced just last week, was that, you know, we're going to take some of these ARPA funds and help subsidize the operating dollars at 35 of our transit agencies here in the US. I think it's a new reality, Alex, that public transit has become nationalized, so to speak, not in the sense of a Venezuela national government takeover, but in the sense that the national government has realized we need to fund public transit agencies in a real and meaningful way. So now it's our opportunity as transit agencies, that was your question, what do we do, to not just do the same old, same old. There's so many new great ideas that are out there right now, just like I was mentioning earlier, right? Where we can make public policy a new focus area of public transit, things like environmental stewardship and equity and inclusion. We can actually use transit to improve these areas in our communities. We can make fare payment and services more equitable. We can focus on electrification and zero emission buses. We can make our transit agencies strengthen their hiring and career development programs so that a transit agency becomes more than just a place where you ride a bus. It's a place where you can actually get training in technology, all the new tech that's coming out. And we can take this opportunity to redesign our routes and add more frequent service, right? Like Kevin Quinn told me, frequency is freedom. And I think we need to expand our demand response and microtransit services, really combining up, some people are doing it themselves. Microtransit is operating on their own. Other places like PalmTran, where I just met down with Clinton Forbes and Chad Hockman, they're contracting it out to MV Transportation, who's running it for them. But getting this door-to-door kind of microtransit service and integrating it into our overall service, it really also creates an opportunity to make sure no one is left behind. Because if you move a route because there's not enough people to justify it, you still have grandma who needs to get to her bridge game on Tuesday nights. So you let that microtransit vehicle serve that area and suddenly she doesn't get left behind. So it's all part of that inclusion that we're looking for.
Right. Yeah, I've told people, and you know, during this pandemic, it's amazing, you know, what 10 years of marketing, you know, I've been in the industry 14, 15 years now, you know, 10 years of that marketing, maybe since I've come in, has been about going after the choice rider. You know, we're attractive to the choice rider. We're really going after that market. And I think in the last 2 years, that's done more to attract those choice riders, to attract people that are interested in getting out of their cars and you know, being good stewards to the areas that they're living in as well. Why do you think that the last 2 years has made such a difference? You know, 10 plus years of messaging, you know, hadn't.
Yep. So there's a guy named Anthony Robbins who wrote a book called Unlimited Power. People have heard of him, Tony Robbins. He's a famous, you know, motivational speaker. 10, 15 years ago, I was really into his stuff. And one of the things he says is you can't change somebody's personality once they're an adult, unless there's a major crisis in their life, kind of like slap across the face, so much so it knocks you to the ground and you have to build yourself back up. Well, that's kind of what COVID was to the transit industry. Right. I have been calling it a gut punch. It was a gut punch, right? Because we've been worshiping at the false idol of ridership. And suddenly our commuter services dropped 90% of ridership. And we were like, it's an inflection point. What do we do now? It's an opportunity for us to reevaluate what was our reason d'etre? What's our reason to exist? And I think we came out with, it's not just commuter riders. That's not, and it never has been only that, but that was our primary reason, right? That's why we did peak of the peak pricing, you know, and in some cities. I remember Jeremy Yap in Singapore told me, I'm so glad one of the great bright sides of COVID was we got away from peak of the peak because we had to have so many of our resources, you know, from that 1 hour, you know, from 5 to 6 p.m. at night for the people going home and in the morning, you know, from 7 to 8. We had all these extra buses and now we can just let it calm down and we can try to fill in the gaps in the day and make transit and even the commuter rail. We can do some stuff at nighttime, right? Getting people into ball games or midday to visit the museums in the cities as things open back up. And so that's what I think it took, Alex. It took a massive global gut punch to public transit to make us reevaluate what are we here for? And we came out, I think, with a much more holistic view of the role public transit can play in communities.
What's one of maybe, you know, a couple of the major changes you're seeing coming out of COVID? I know definitely the mindset of doing more with less has changed and finding new ways to kind of fill gaps has been a big step. I mean, what would you say are kind of the couple things?
Well, you know, the thing we heard a lot of last year was customer experience. And I think that's still a big one, right? So we're not just focused on running the bus from A to B, but we're focused on the experience that the customer has from the start of their journey. So this means from the moment they walk one step out of their house, they're now on their commute. How can we serve them? And that's where the microtransit and the bikes and the scooters and all that come in, because it can get them on that literally that first and last mile. Then you got guys like Phil Verster in, you know, Metrolinx up in who runs Go Bus and Go Train in Toronto, who's done things like, you know, created a great customer experience. While you're at work during the day, you can order your groceries online and have them waiting for you in a refrigerated locker back at the train station when you get back there. So, I mean, the sky is the limit when it comes to our creativity and the ability to make things work better for people, make their lives simpler. Transit can do that. I just interviewed a lady on my podcast who runs a train service in Malaysia to the from downtown Kuala Lumpur to the airport. And one cool thing she told me that I thought was amazing was, you order your coffee ahead of time on the train. And when you get there, there's literally somebody standing there waiting to hand it to you, the coffee you ordered. And also the other thing was, when you put your bags on the train, same thing Brightline does. When you get on the train and at Brightline, they actually will come to your house and pick you up in a car. You put your bags in the car. They put them in there for you, like, you know, concierge service. You never have to handle them again. They'll take you to the cruise line. And they'll put them on the cruise line for you. They'll take you to the airport, put them. So those kind of customer service things will bring a whole new group of people into public transit if they can get the services that really make their lives, you know, easier and better.
Yeah.
You want to talk music? We got 2 minutes left. We can talk music.
Sure. We've got some time.
Okay. All right. Good.
Yeah. So, I wanted to actually segue. I did mention I wanted to ask you about your kind of music career. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, transit's role in growing that equity inclusion and kind of discuss a little bit about what your book will be about?
Sure. So thank you. I was thinking about the role of transit changing earlier last year and how it really was changing. People were taking this as an inflection point. And one of the big things that it became apparent was, I mean, APTA had taken leadership and other groups have talked a lot about it, but I really felt like public transit has the ability to do more than just transforming from A to B. We can actually change the shape, the nature, and the dynamic of our communities because mobility is that significant of an impact on people's lives. And so, for instance, I was just talking to Terry White, the CEO of King County Metro, and he grew up riding public transit. And without it, his mom had a disability where she couldn't drive. Without it, he couldn't have done anything. That's how he got to school. That's how he got everywhere. And so he grew up, and it really made a difference in his life. Now think about if he actually had good quality service, where it wasn't on 1 hour headways, but maybe he had 15 minute headways where he could go wherever he wants, or like a paratransit system where you don't have to dial ahead 24 hours in advance, but you can put it on your phone, dial it in where you want to go, and it'll come pick you up at your house within an hour, like a cab or an Uber would. Think about the impact that these improvements in public transit would have in people's lives. People of color, lower income people, elderly people with disabilities. You know, I spent most of my career, or a big chunk of it, working in ADA paratransit. I ran Washington, D.C., WMATA's paratransit system for 5 years as a contractor, heading up as director of operations there. And I really believe in the power of transit to improve people with disabilities' lives. And this is really the next phase of that in a way. And so, yeah, so public transit, you know, internally, we got to, you know, like Michael Jackson said, the man in the mirror, right? Look at ourselves. You know how I'm working in music. See, we got to look at ourselves and make a change. So we got to change ourselves, right? And make sure we got good promotional efforts in our, and make sure that our boards and our, you know, senior leadership look like the people we're serving, but also in the communities that we serve. You know, for instance, Julie Tim down in Richmond, Virginia, told me I'm interviewing her for my book. The book is going to be called Equity and Inclusion in Public Transportation, and basically. Yeah. It's transcripts from interviews with some of the top leaders in the world about what they're doing right now to improve equity and inclusion. Right. So it'll hopefully come out later this year. But basically, you know, she was saying, look, we've always had our best bus shelters in downtown Richmond for the white collar commuters. But people of color who live out in the community, they get a stick in the mud that says bus stop on it. And so we're going to change that. We're going to start putting shelters out in the community where people who actually need and rely on public transit can use them as well. So they don't have to stand there in the rain, et cetera. Those are just simple, practical things. Or like Alex Wiggins, my buddy who runs New Orleans Transit, you know, is now looking at everything through the lens of equity and inclusion. And he's in the book as well. And so those are that's what the book is about. The book is an opportunity. It's a collaboration. It's really like it's taking the podcast to the next step, just like my book, The Future of Public Transportation, was 40 chapters written by leaders in public transit around the world. This is interviews that I'm conducting that won't be on the podcast. They're separate, where these folks are saying, this is what I'm doing right now. And what I'm hoping is public transit leaders can pull this book off the shelf, flip it open, read a chapter and say, hey, that's a good idea. I should do that. And so it's going to be a practical guide.
Why do you think the last couple of years has... For some reason, and I don't know if it's because I'm in the industry like you are, but I don't know why the last 2 years it seems like the focus of equity and inclusion in a way kind of starts with public transit. Am I wrong there, or is that something you see as well?
Yeah, I think there is something to that. You know, we had a bunch of series of racial justice incidents happened here in the U.S., as you know, over the last couple of years, that really focused the public's attention on it. And when the public gets focused on something, the policymakers, you know, the politicians say, oh, yes, I see. That's important now. Public transit, it's always been important. We've always understood the importance that we played. But I think the policymakers now, the legislators have figured out, there's a linkage here. We actually have a tool in our toolbox that we didn't know about to help produce greater equity and inclusion. So they're focused on it now. And on the boards and the governing bodies that fund us, they've said, hey, we want you to make that a priority. And we're like, great, we kind of always have, but you know, if you give us some extra money and some extra attention, look at all this other great improvements we can make in people's lives. So I think now that it's become the topic du jour, I think that's what my buddy Paul Tolliver said, you know, he said, we were always focused on this, man, but it's become the topic du jour in the general population. Now it's funneled through the politicians and the funding to say, and, you know, even the current administration has said that's going to be a top priority for theirs when it comes to funding public transit, is making sure that we're working on equity inclusion in our communities. So I'm super pumped about it. I think, you know, the reason I got into all this stuff, Alex, in the beginning, my dad was a minister and, you know, I always wanted to help people. I never felt like my job was to go into full, you know, become a preacher or a minister, you know, although Reverend Comfort is a pretty cool name. but I felt like I could do more through the government and I could really help people in government. And that's really what my whole life and career has been about from the very beginning, where for 7 years, you know, I worked with the Department of Aging Transportation and grew it into a public transit system, helping the elderly and disabled access, you know, medical appointments and all that. It just, ministers to my soul. I don't know how else to say it, but I, you know, you go home every day feeling full inside. I've made a difference in someone's life today, or 10 people, or 100, or when you're a CEO of MTA, you're making a difference in hundreds of thousands of people every day. And, you know, and public transit, I can't think of a better place to do that. So it kind of comes full circle from where I started to where we're at now in equity and inclusion. It's the same thing. It's improving people's lives and using something that was already there, but refocusing and repurposing it to make sure that it's doing a great job in that area.
I've spoken to a lot of people in transit who got into it, you know, viewing it as a public service. So it's got to be very satisfying to now, you know, have that role kind of that spotlight on them as they focus on equity and inclusion.
And being a transit evangelist, which I call myself, it's a great way to, I'm able to shine a spotlight using the, you know, the Transit Unplugged podcast, the TV show, and my speeches on, you know, what do I do in the podcast? I interview people about what they're doing. And so, so, you know, people like, we've already mentioned a lot of the names, but these leaders who are doing tremendous things, I'm able to kind of amplify that. And we have a global spotlight now to make that happen. And right. Thank you for helping to continue that. I know your magazine and this podcast are doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's an important issue to me, having you know, grown up as a minority and understanding the kind of struggles of people in their inner community and the ability for them to come up, really relying on the fact of access to jobs, right? And needing the access to jobs and transit playing a huge role in providing that access. As promised, I wanted to talk to you. I think a lot of people maybe don't know that you're a musician. I know myself, I kind of looked over and saw you playing the piano one night at a party and was like, you know, is there anything this guy does not do? You know, hey, I could talk to you about everything. And then also I'll play a little song. Can you kind of talk a little bit about how that came about and, you know, how it plays a part in your life right now?
Sure. So I love music. I, at one time I thought about, you know, going, making it professional. We had a band in college called Sons of Thunder, and I wrote 50 songs. We played mostly originals. Of course, nobody wants to hear originals. They want to hear cover tunes. My son's band, Hot Tub Limo, and now his new band, Equals B, they do a lot of cover tunes, and they've become very popular here. But I love music. It's always been a real important part of my life. Less so, you know, during the child rearing years when I was so focused. My wife and I have six kids and now six grandkids. And so took a less role. But now that, you know, I've only got two kids at home, I've gotten more back into music, and both my boys, Daniel and Joseph, both are great musicians and play a lot at shows and stuff like that. And so I've been able to play with them some. And you know, when I was working at the Department of Aging, I'd play piano for the seniors in the senior centers. We do sing-alongs at Christmas and stuff like that. But now what I do is when I go to a different city, whether it's Glasgow, Scotland, or Baltimore, Maryland, and I play the pianos in their metro subway systems and do a free show for people there. And do some stuff, you know, on Facebook and LinkedIn. Once in a while, people ask me to play a few songs, and I'll do shows at coffee houses and stuff like that. And for a while, just before COVID, when I would go to a new city to speak at a conference or whatever, I would try to go to an open mic night. And so I did that in Toronto and a few other cities and brought a bunch of fun friends with me, and we'd have a bunch of fun with it. So I still love music, still play it. And I think, to be honest with you, music is, you know, it's a universal language, right? Literally, right. I mean, because the you know, when you look at a staff of music, they read it the same, you know, in Azerbaijan as they do here in America. It's the same music. That's kind of cool. But also, music is part of the arts. And I think that's an untapped resource in public transit. When public transit was trying to, you know, ratchet down their budgets and all like that, a lot of the public art projects that we were doing got left out. And I think now another way that public transit can encourage people to do more than just get people from A to B is to do it in a fun way. So you've got people like, you know, Memphis and Nashville that have turned their, you know, transit to turn their bus stops or bus shelters into local art things, you know, and art in facilities, but music especially, and putting pianos in train stations or out in your bus hubs and just leaving it there, you know, undercover, and anybody can play. I haven't heard anybody have any trouble with that. Right. It's a great fun way to just, you know, create an exciting part of transit even better.
Well, great, Paul. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. You know, look forward to, I think there's still some meat on the bone to have you back soon, talk about some more stuff. So thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex. And thank you for the great work you're doing there to promote our industry in America.